I mentioned before, we're going to be in Mark 14 this morning. So we'll be in Mark 14, starting in verse 32. I would encourage you to turn there, or if you have a Bible app on your phone, you can follow along there. We'll be looking at this passage throughout our time this morning. I don't know if any of you have ever watched the Tour de France, but most of you have are probably aware that it is a cycling competition. And if you've ever seen the way that these riders pedal so quickly, you might wonder some of the mechanics behind it. How does this work? How do they do this? It is 4,000 kilometers, which is 2,485 miles for those of us on this side of the pond. They ride for 3 weeks, about every day. And they add up all the times from each of the stages that they've done, and the person with the shortest amount of time wins. So, as you can imagine, they're riding through the Alps, the Pyrenees Mountains, the plains of France, where there's these intense crosswinds coming across the road. So they're fighting against a lot of resistance as they do this. But they have this special technique called drafting that they use to avoid having all of the pressure of the wind and the ride on them. They have to train lots of hours to prepare, but I'm sure that many of these hours are spent practicing the art of drafting, because I don't know if you've ever watched them, but the wheels are inches away. And if there's ever any kind of accident up at the front of the pack, it just, all these bikes just roll over each other and crash into each other because it's so precise. They have to keep it so tight to benefit. But the energy that they save is incredible. Some scientists estimate that they may reduce their energy needed by about 40% by drafting like this, which over the course of 3 weeks, every day, riding all day, as you can imagine, would have a massive impact on your legs. They have techniques like the Peloton group, which is at the very front, and they all form together, and then they cycle through who is up at the front. When they're on those plains of France that I mentioned with the strong crosswinds, they form a sort of diamond-shaped formation. They call that the echelon. You might have noticed some bike brands have picked up those names as part of their branding. But the intensity of what they're doing and the pressure and the trial, the testing that they're facing, is reduced by depending on the others in the pack, the others in the group, to help them to get through it and to be able to endure that intense test. And in today's passage, we find Jesus at the beginning of his greatest suffering on earth. But to endure it, he doesn't rely on some special resource that we don't have access to. Surprisingly, perhaps, the most incredible feature of how he endures through this suffering is to go to his Father in dependence, to pray to him, to call out to him, and to submit to his will. And what's incredible as well is that Jesus doesn't just do this as an example to us. And certainly there's much more going on than Jesus just being an example. But in this passage, he calls his followers to do the exact same thing. He tells his disciples to watch and pray so that they will not enter into temptation. So it's not just that we can access this, but it's actually that Jesus commands us to access this as we face temptation. So let's read through this passage and look for how Jesus goes through this process of suffering. And you might say, he's not at the cross yet. But as we read through this passage and study through it, I think it will become very clear that this was as much suffering as he endured, and perhaps even more, but at least as much suffering as he endured once in the future on the cross, very shortly. He endured in the garden as he faced the reality of what was coming in his separation from the Father and the wrath of the Father being poured out on him. So let's read this passage together. Mark 14, we'll start in verse 32. And it says this, Mark writes to us. They went to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." And he took with him Peter and James and John. and began to be greatly distressed and troubled. And he said to them, My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch. And going a little farther, he fell on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me. Yet, not what I will, but what you will. And he came and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, Simon, are you asleep? Could you not watch 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. And again he went away and prayed, saying the same words. And again he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were very heavy, and they did not know what to answer him. And he came the third time and said to them, Are you still sleeping and taking your rest? It is enough. The hour has come. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise. Let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand. As we come into this passage, we see very clearly what Jesus does. He goes to his Father in his moment of trial. But notice this isn't the first time that Jesus has done this. We find in the book of Mark other occasions where Jesus was in intense moments of ministry or at the beginning when he's about to go out and embark in ministry, and he goes to the Father and spends time with him, seeking his help. Mark 1:35-39 says this, Rising very early in the morning while it was still dark, he departed and went out to a desolate place, and there he prayed. And Simon and those who were with him searched for him, and they found him and said to him, Everyone is looking for you. And he said to them, Let us go on to the next town, so that I may preach there also, for that is why I came out. And he went throughout all Galilee, preaching in their synagogues and casting out demons. You see, as he spends time with God the Father, he is strengthened to go and fulfill the mission that he's been sent on. There's this temptation all throughout the time that Jesus is on earth, as people gather around him and pressure him and want him to overthrow the Romans, that he could actually appease them. He had the power to do that. He could have overthrown the Romans and sought to rule at that time. But he depends on the Father, and as he does this, he stays on the mission that the Father has given him. In Mark 6, we find that at the beginning, in verse 31, he tells the disciples, Come away by yourselves to a desolate place and rest a while. But all the pressure of the crowds come. He feeds the 5,000. What's his response immediately after doing that? It says, after he had taken leave of them, he went up on the mountain to pray. So after all this pressure of ministry and being tired and worn out, he still fulfills his responsibility to care for the people there. But as soon as that's done, he goes and gets away with his Father and spends time with him, strengthened for the ministry that God has for him to do. So what do we find in chapter 14? Verse 32, they come to this garden, Gethsemane, which later on becomes apparent that this is a common place that Jesus would go with his disciples. That's where Judas knows to find him. And he tells his disciples to sit and wait there while he goes to pray. It's clear that what he is doing. But notice verse 33. This might surprise us a little bit. He takes Peter and James and John, who are the closest inner circle of disciples, with him. And it says he began to be greatly distressed and troubled. This is a peek into the emotions that Jesus experienced while on this earth. He was fully human, while yet still retaining being fully God. He experienced the full range of emotions that we experience. And you might think, well, wait a second. He knew what was coming. He knew what was going to happen. But as a human, he still felt the pressure. Even this morning, as we gathered to pray this morning, we were talking about the hardship that it is as human beings to know that, yes, one day we'll be with Jesus, but as we face difficulties and struggles right now in our lives, it's hard for us. And Jesus experienced that same thing. It says he was distressed. And the first word here is only found in Mark. And it's the idea of being distressed or alarmed. In chapter 9, verse 15, the crowd is worked up because the disciples can't cast out a demon. And so when Jesus appears, they're alarmed and they're saying, hey, they're excited and saying, hey, we need your help with this. They're all worked up. And then in chapter 16, which we'll get to later on, it's used to describe the women who come to see just the angel in the tomb. And they're alarmed and think, where's Jesus? What's going on? What's happening? And Jesus says he's distressed and he's troubled. The agony that he faces here in the garden is unlike any other agony that anyone in the history of the world has experienced, because he goes through the full intensity of the temptation to say, I don't really want to do this. I don't want to go through with this. Understanding, of course, that he doesn't sin in going too far and not fulfilling the Father's will. And certainly the entire time he's submitted to the Father's will, but he experiences the full range of temptation and resistance and turns from it. And how does he do this? By going to his Father. Listen to Hebrews 5:7 as it describes what Jesus experienced. It says, in the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears. Is that how you expect Jesus to respond in trial? Or is it that you expect that he would experience that intensity? To him who is able to save him from death, the Father could have said, okay, you don't have to do this. And he was heard because of his reverence. Wait a second. He was heard? But he still went through it. What does that mean? It means that the Father heard his prayer and knew what was best, what they had planned from eternity past, and he empowered him to go through with it and to embrace the suffering that he was going to experience. There's this tension that, on the one hand, Jesus experiences all the agony of what it would be like to have to go through this process and to suffer, and yet, on the other hand, he willingly does it without sinning, without giving in to temptation to say, I'm not going to do this. He always said, I will submit to the will of the Father. And it says in Hebrews that God the Father heard him. And it's implied that he answered him. And the answer to Jesus, his own son, was no, I will not take this cup from you. That ought to encourage us. As we face the greatest suffering that we experience in this life, we can go to God who is a good Father. And even when he says no, we can know that he loves us just as much as he loves his son and loves his son. And that he cares for us in our suffering. And that he knows the absolute best thing that can happen to us. So maybe he takes the suffering away. And maybe he doesn't. But as a Father who rules over all things and sees everything and knows everything that's going on, he knows what we need. As I've thought about this, I think maybe a very simple way to understand this concept is you think of a child going to his father and saying, Dad, I want to eat this candy bar. And the dad says to the son, knowing that the candy bar would be an enjoyable experience for him, did you finish your vegetables? Because that's something you need to do. You can't just live off of candy bars. You will, even though you will enjoy the moment of eating it, the father knows that the health of his child is at stake if he only eats candy bars. And so he says, no, you need to eat the vegetables. And sure, some kids enjoy certain vegetables, and that's a good thing. But probably most kids would choose, if they could, the candy bar over the vegetables, at least some of the time. And so the father's responsibility is to say, is my child eating enough of the good stuff so that when he enjoys the bad stuff, it's not going to hurt him? But to the child, he says, no, the vegetables would be a bad experience for me and the candy bar would be a good experience. But the father knows what the child needs. And so for us, when we face suffering or difficulty, we look at it and we say, I only see the suffering. I don't understand what the good here is. But God, as a perfect Father who knows exactly what we need and who has told us that the greatest good for us is that we walk with Him, chooses to take away things or to bring pressures or difficulties into our lives to turn us to Him, because He knows that there is no greater good than that we can walk closely with Him. And in this case, the Father knows, and certainly Jesus as God knows as well, that the only way for humanity to be saved is by Jesus going to the cross and enduring the suffering. So let's talk about the suffering for a moment. Jesus says that His soul is sorrowful in verse 34, even to death. Why? Why? What's so hard about this? We might look at this and say, sure, the cross is painful, but thieves and others experience crucifixion. Why is that so difficult and painful? I don't think here the focus is on the physical suffering that Jesus will experience. I think here that what it says when Jesus is talking about His soul being sorrowful is that His person, His soul, His very being is going to experience something incredibly painful that none of us will have to experience or could possibly experience. Because in Mark 10:45 it says that even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give His life as a ransom for many. What does that mean? We find in Isaiah 53, we've looked at before, that He will answer for all of the sins of history. Isaiah 53, 4 and 5 says this, "Surely He has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed Him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon Him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with His wounds we are healed." What does that mean, the chastisement? We don't use that word ever outside of the Bible, I don't think. So maybe we read over it and we say, that's a big word and it sounds bad, but what does it mean? It means all of the consequences of our sin were poured out on Jesus. All of the punishment that brings us peace. That means the wrath of God that all of us deserve was poured out on Jesus. If you think about it, each of us deserves the punishment for our own sin. And the only payment for that is separation from God, death, eternally, separation from God. But Jesus took all of the punishment for all of us in this room, for all of us, all of the humans in the greater Milwaukee area, 1.5 million people, all of the people in the whole world, 8 billion plus people that are alive today, the billions and billions and billions of people that have ever lived in the history of the world have all sinned. And Jesus took every single one of those sins on Him at the cross. It's not something that we can fathom to understand what Jesus was going to bear on the cross. It's a weight that no person could bear on their own. Only the Son of God could bear this weight. And yet He did it for us. In Isaiah 53:12, it says, "Therefore I will divide Him a portion with the many, and He shall divide the spoil with the strong, because He poured out His soul to death." Remember what Jesus says, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death." He poured out His soul. It's hard to imagine what that means. "And was numbered with the transgressors. Yet He bore the sin of many and makes intercession for the transgressors." He bears our sin. And so we can go to God. He intercedes for us. And we see in Mark 15:34 what the weight of this is for Him. "At the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, 'Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani.'" Why does it have the actual words here that Jesus spoke that aren't in English in our translation? It's because in the book of Mark, Mark uses the actual words that Jesus said. And then it interprets it. Mark wants us to sit there and hear those words. And then he says, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? What does that mean? Jesus, God the Father, God the Holy Spirit, one God in three persons. We can't fully understand exactly what that means, but Scripture makes it clear that it's true. Have existed forever in a relationship that is described by Jesus in John 17 as being one, a perfect relationship together. They've had perfect fellowship. Think about the friend that you've known the longest, that you're the closest to. And then multiply that into eternity past forever. That's impossible. And think about if that person abandoned you or betrayed you. Now, certainly God the Father did not betray Jesus, but in this moment, the experience that he had was the same. My God, why have you forsaken me? God the Father, as you sing about it, turns his face away. That had never happened ever before in their relationship. Jesus was more alone than he had ever been. And it says, as we sing, every sin on him was laid. So the weight of the sin and the weight of the Father turning away from him and that feeling of forsakenness was what Jesus was sorrowful about unto death, and that he poured his soul out too. But listen to this. Jesus faced the wrath of his Father so that you would never have to. Think about that. Jesus faced that wrath of his own Father so that you would never have to. And that's what he's going through here in the garden. Listen to what his disciples did. In John 16, 31 and 32, Jesus answered them and said, do you now believe? Behold, the hour is coming. Indeed, it has come when you will be scattered, each to his own home, and will leave me alone. He's describing what his disciples are about to do. Yet I am not alone, for the Father is with me. So we say, wait a second, he forsook him on the cross, yes, but in the garden the Father was with him, giving him the strength to make it through the cross. And Hebrews 12, 3 and 4 tells us this, consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. An encouragement for us to follow God is found in his struggle. It says in verse 4, in your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. Because of what Jesus did, you can resist the sin, the temptation that you face. So Jesus goes to his Father in his moment of trial. And we find it described in verse 35. He says, going a little farther, he fell on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. The agony that he experienced is described in the other Gospels, that he sweated drops of blood. But here, Mark makes it clear that this was a moment of intense pain and agony. And he cries out these words, Abba, Father. This idea of the close-knit relationship with the Father. The idea of almost like saying daddy. But in this context, the idea here is just to show the closeness and the tightness of their relationship and the complete dependence that Jesus has on his Father. All things are possible for you. Think about that. God the Father could have said, you don't have to go to the cross. All things are possible. Remove this cup from me. He didn't say, please, exactly. He's begging God to remove this cup from him. Yet, again, that tension, not what I will, but what you will. He submits to the Father. And then verse 39, again, it says, he went away and prayed, saying the same words. It's hard for us to imagine what these moments must have been like, the incredible pain that Jesus endured. So Jesus goes to his Father in this moment of trial. What does that mean for us? Well, we don't have to wait long to find out, because Jesus goes to his disciples and calls his followers to go to the Father in their moment of trial. And you say, wait a second, were they supposed to pray for themselves or for Jesus? Well, I think at the beginning we could say it would make sense if they love Jesus and they see the sorrow that he's in, that they should have been praying for him. But what Jesus calls them to do when he comes back is he says, watch and pray that you will not enter into temptation. And this verse really hit me this week. He says, Simon, are you asleep? Could you not watch 1 hour? So I want to ask you the question. I'm not going to have people raise hands. But I want you to think about this. How many times in your life have you prayed for an hour? So I just want you to think about that in the context of what Jesus is calling us to do. Not to say that every day you don't pray an hour, you're living in complete sin. But just to say that in moments of intense suffering or intense prayer, there should be occasions where that is a standard, not something to hold up and say, if I've missed this, I've sinned and I failed. But to say, that's kind of a measure for us, to say, Jesus expects that his followers could pray for an hour for something that's intense and important. But notice what he calls them to pray for. He says, watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. So what's the implication here? That if we do not watch and pray like we should, what will happen? We will enter into temptation. We will give in to sin. So think about it. Have you recently given in to sin? The implication here is that we cannot resist temptation without the help of God the Father. And so if we are not praying to him, we are not able to resist temptation like we should. We need prayer. We need to go to God in prayer for help. Why is that? He says the spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. We've all experienced that. Romans 7 makes it super clear as Paul writes to the people of Rome that there's this struggle inside of us. Our flesh wants to do what's wrong, and if we know Christ as our Savior, his spirit inside of us and our own soul and desire is that we would not give in to that temptation. And there's this wrestling match going on. And here Jesus says, we need to pray to ask for God's help. And the implication would be as well that we ought to pray for others too in their moments of distress. We desperately need God's help. In Hebrews 11:6, it says, without faith, it is impossible to please him. For whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. Here's a question for you. If you go through your life without praying, are you living like God exists or like he doesn't exist? If you live without prayer, you're living like God doesn't exist. And in Hebrews it says it's impossible to please God. The way that we live by faith is to draw near to God, which you can't do without talking to him, and believe that he exists. Live that out. Live in a way that communicates that you believe that God exists. So, the book of Hebrews is written to Christians. We desperately need God's help, even as believers, to respond in trust and obedience to God. Jesus needed to depend on the Father to be able to get through the cross. The disciples here, this is maybe one of the most frightening aspects of this, didn't actively choose to sin in this context. They didn't say, okay, we're going to go steal some stuff, murder some people, whatever it was, while Jesus prays in the garden. They just fell asleep. And yet what they did was sin. Jesus said, why are you not praying? Because you're going to enter temptation. And it led to sin. They abandoned Jesus. They denied Jesus. So, I don't think the point here is that instead of sleeping, we should always pray. We need sleep. The Bible talks about God giving to his beloved ones sleep. So this is not against sleep, but this is saying there are certain moments when you shouldn't be apathetic. We cannot be apathetic in our walk with God. We need to ask for his help to resist temptation. So their failure to pray was sin. Now, last week, we, if we look at ourselves in the story, as followers of Jesus, would have been with the disciples as those who abandoned Jesus in his moment of deepest need, and yet he welcomes them to his table. This week, in this story, we would be the people who struggle and fight against the temptation to sleep or to be apathetic instead of praying for strength to endure temptation. So my question for you, it's not a physical question, but really a spiritual one. Have you been asleep when you should have been praying? Are there times that you have ignored your need to pray and not asked for God's help to resist temptation, and so you have fallen? And then as we conclude this passage, verses 41 and 42 end this way. Jesus says, "Are you still sleeping and taking your rest?" That's his question to us. Don't be apathetic. Go to God in prayer. But then what does he do? Because of his time in prayer with the Father, he says, "It is enough. The hour has come. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners." He has resigned, or rather submitted himself to the Father, and said, "I'm going to go through with this." Because of the time that he spent with the Father in dependence, he now fulfills the mission that he's been called to and goes into the suffering. He could have left the garden, but he chose not to. He stayed there. And he says, "Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." And it will become clear that when he says, "Let us be going," he doesn't mean "I'm leaving the garden." He means, "I'm going to be crucified. I'm going to endure the suffering that God has called me to." And I have this quote as I was studying this. It stood out to me by one of the commentators on the book of Mark. He said this: "What profound irony Gethsemane conceals. For when Jesus feels the most excluded from God's presence, he is in fact closest to God's will. Gethsemane is the prelude to Calvary, for in a valley beneath the city, Jesus allows his soul to be crucified. On a hill above the city, he relinquishes his body." What is he saying? He is saying that Jesus felt the farthest from the Father in the garden, and yet he was the closest to following God's will, because he was committed to submitting to what the Father had called him to do. And that is a prelude or a picture as he goes along the way to the cross. It was the inside, on the inside of him, what was happening was what was going to be physically reflected as he was crucified on the cross and killed for us. So, as we think about how we ought to respond to the truths that we find here in the book of Mark, what are some of these ways? Consider the cost of your admission into God's presence. What did it cost Jesus for you to be able to go to God? Remember, the temple, the curtain in the temple was torn, where only one priest could go before everyone was welcomed because of what Jesus did into God's presence. But it wasn't cheap or free. We think about the gift that Jesus offers. It doesn't cost us anything, but it costs him everything. If relationship with God and closeness with God the Father is the thing that we were created for, how much more God the Son in a perfect relationship with him, that was the most important thing that he had, and yet he gave that up to bear our sin. Even if it was for moments, it's hard for us to fathom the agony that he experienced. We cannot comprehend it. That was the cost of our admission. So then think about this. Maybe you've gotten a pass, or someone has gifted you a pass to some attraction, Six Flags, a museum, the science museums, or those kinds of things, and you can go whenever you want. What do? You know that thing is valuable? You go as many times as you possibly can. So I want you to picture for a moment, if you were given a pass like that to your favorite restaurant, Now, I'm not talking about a restaurant where you go and you there's only one thing you like and you get it every time and you would get sick if you ate that all the time. I'm talking about like a restaurant you love that you could always find something different and you could go every day and you would love to go there every day and eat. And someone gives you a pass that you can just eat whenever you want, whatever you want. You would use that pass all the time. Think about it. You never have to prepare meals. For those of you who want healthy food, you could eat healthy food every time you go. For those of you who like to mix it up with unhealthy food, you could do that too. Just pick whatever, and you could just have it whenever you want it. You wouldn't have to do any work except just to go. Think about how much you would go there. You might just buy a house right next to that restaurant so that you could just walk over there at any time and go to it. Now, think about what has been purchased for you, access to God the Father. And in this passage, the strength to resist any sin anytime you need it. It's a lot like food. We need food to give us strength to live. And yet God the Father, through Jesus the Son, has purchased for us an all-access pass at any moment, any time, to give us the strength to resist sin. We ought to use that. So, I don't think any of us probably have been using that like we should. I know as I read this passage this week, I was convicted about that, that I need to go to God more and ask for his help to resist temptation. And maybe a place to start would be to confess your lack of dependence and ask God's forgiveness for not going to him and seeking his help. And then remember that we need to run to God every day. Notice he says, watch and pray that you will not enter into temptation. So last night I asked our kids, where do you hear something like that? Where else do you hear something like that in the Gospels? So they asked for a tip to help them figure it out. So I said, our Father who is in heaven, and then they finished the Lord's Prayer. And I stopped them when it says, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. What do we find in that prayer? Give us this day our daily bread. That's a prayer we're supposed to pray every day. So then, the other part that says, lead us not into temptation, we need to pray that every day too. And certainly that is not saying that God puts us in temptation that we cannot experience. And we find in other passages it says God doesn't tempt us with sin. But what is being asked there is that God will deliver us from temptation, that he will keep us from giving in to temptation that we face. And that's something we need to do daily. If you don't go to God to ask for his help to fight temptation, you will fall and you will fail. If you depend on him completely, you will not. You will never fail to resist temptation. And certainly the problem that we face this side of being with God forever is that there will be times that we don't go to him like we should. But we always need to pray and ask for God's help to resist the temptations that we face. And notice, we didn't talk a lot about it, but notice that this is in the moment of trial and testing. So think about the moments that you are most in trial and testing. Perhaps when you're short on sleep, or when you get a health diagnosis that you weren't expecting, or various stages of life, we experience great difficulty and great suffering. And that's going to be different for each one of us. But we will always face temptation when we face those times of suffering to doubt God. And instead, we need to go to him and ask for his help that we will not give in to temptation. So let's pray and ask God for help to resist temptation and to go to him and ask for his help regularly. And to pray for each other, to do that as well. Before we close with some announcements and then benediction, let's pray. Father, that we can do